Wait for it, wait for it, and we're live. Hey, all you crazy sci-fi and fantasy fans, it's time for your daily dose of shenanigans over here at the Blasters and Blades podcast. Just a couple of nerdy veterans and one chaos coordinator geeking out over our science fiction passions and fantastical fantasies. A place where magic is king, the sky is the limit, and space is the place. We are the podcast that puts the fun in dysfunction. So without further ado, we're gonna let the guests introduce themselves. We're gonna start with returning friend of the show, Mr. David Hensley.
David, hello.
David.
Hi, I'm David Hensley. I write science fiction and fantasy, well, military sci-fi, and hi. Once again, I'm David Hensley. I write mil sci-fi, military fantasy for Three Ravens Publishing. You can find me at davidwhensley.com.
All right, next, because I let the oracle known as Word. No, you're good, Dave. I let the oracle known as Word alphabetize everything. So we've got Mr. John Ringo. Can you introduce yourself to our listeners and viewers who might not know who you are?
Hi, John Ringo. I write a variety of stuff, mostly science fiction. Most recent stuff is a gaming lit series with Lydia Scherer, which started with Into the Real, and the second book just came out was Through the Storm. And I'm doing my first book in a long time that's really mine was just came out or is about to come out, which is called Beyond the Ranges, and I'm also doing a Substack.
Nice. What are you going to be doing on your Substack? Are you going to be putting actual like blog post type deals?
No, it's I'm serializing a series, which to try to explain that series is very complicated. So we'll wait.
Okay. And last but certainly not least, we've got Mr. William Joseph Roberts.
Wait, you want me to introduce myself? I mean, I think everybody knows who I am at this point.
Yeah, but, you know, what if John's fans don't know who you are yet?
That's fair. That's fair. Okay. So I am William Joseph Roberts, a.k.a. Hillbilly. I write sci-fi, fantasy, horror, anything the evil mind squirrels demand of me, and I am the lead publisher at Three Ravens Publishing.
And finally, we've got my intrepid co-host finally able to make it back because the work let him free, Ranger Nick, who shoots people and knows things and drinks sometimes coffee, sometimes bourbon. Who knows? We don't judge.
Or I merged the two. You know, little power couple going. Bourbon.
No, that's a power couple I can get behind.
Yeah.
All right. And the next part of the introduction, dear listeners, how I found this group of fine gentlemen. We actually rode the same dropship on the assault of Proxima Centauri. It's now declassified, so we can talk about it. And from there, we've just been friends. You know, you kill a few alien bugs together, and it kind of makes you bond. True story. Or I stole it from a movie. Well, who knows?
The only good bugs are dead, bud.
Or you've been playing Helldiver 2.
That too. So the first part is out of the way. Now, John, since you're new to the show, we've got to ask you the religion questions. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
Star Wars, Star Trek, or Firefly?
I'm wearing a Blue Sun t-shirt, for God's sakes.
I'd say that answers the answer is Firefly, because that is.
And please understand, two of those are heretical. They don't really exist as religions. They say that they're religions, but in the field of sci-fi and of science fiction, you can't describe them as religions. They're not the true faith. They're only true faiths. They are the face of the book, and they are Firefly, Babylon 5, and The Expanse. That's it. Those other things, they're heretical, okay? They should just be tossed to the side and forgotten.
All right. And next, because we are polytheistic, Game of Thrones, The Wheel of Time, or Chronicles of Narnia?
Sorry, say again?
The Wheel of Time, the Game of Thrones, or Chronicles of Narnia?
Chronicles of Narnia, maybe, sort of. But I think that you left off the biggest one. I mean, the Catholic world-spanning religion of that particular zone, there is only one, Middle Earth. That's it. All the rest of those are simply derivatives thereof.
True, but if we had when we had Lord of the Rings on, everybody only picked that, so we had to like mix it up a little bit just to get some conversations going.
Well, next is Narnia.
Okay, all right, and it's a criminal shame that once you reach adulthood, no one asks you this question. So Stabby suggested we bring it back, and here we are. What is your favorite dinosaur, sir?
My favorite dinosaur, probably remains Brontosaurus from when I was a kid. I was going to go for something really, really interesting, and then I decided that it, no, I'd just be honest, Brontosaurus, it was like, Brontosaurus was the big dinosaur when I was a kid, way before Jurassic Park or any of that stuff. And then he said, oh, there is no Brontosaurus. And then it was like, yes, there is a Brontosaurus. No, turns out there is a Brontosaurus, and then there's another kind of saurus that they thought was Brontosaurus. So there still is Brontosaurus. That's okay. It.
That's an excellent answer. We will accept it. All right. And because we are civilized human beings here at the Blasters and Blades podcast, we are no longer knuckle-dragging troglodytes. Coffee or tea, and how do you take it?
Coffee with cream and sugar.
Okay.
Acceptable. I drink both, but mostly coffee.
That is the right answer. So, all right. So the religion question's out of the way. Uh-oh. I like your cup.
For those who recognize it.
I need to get a new one. My mug finally died. It started leaking, and I hated wearing my coffee. I wanted to drink my coffee, so I'm on the hunt for a new one. And it can't be Stanley because those are just overdone. So
I've got like a dozen of them. So
I need the one with the lid so I don't worry about spilling it on my keyboard. That would be bad. So I try to go with the mugs with the lid.
Stanleys have lids. And optional straw.
Optional straw. All right. So obviously, if you read the title, we're here to talk about contested landings, orbital drops, or playing hard to get. So first off, let's define our terms because we always do that. So what do you think qualifies as orbital insertion? Is it anything that breaks space to planet count for you? Or does there require something more for it to count as an orbital drop?
Well, orbital is a very specific term. It means that you are at a velocity which allows you to assume a stable orbit around a planet. So you can't just say it's like into space because that's suborbital. So if you're like being fired in a rocket from the surface of a planet and then you come down onto another point on the surface of the planet and you have not completed an orbit, that's suborbital. So if you're talking about an orbital drop, that's automatically from space at a speed above a certain level. And you're always going to get, one of the things with an orbital drop is you're always going to get plasma mechanics. On a planet which has an atmosphere similar to Earth's, or at least has a fairly dense atmosphere. So with SpaceX's last shot of Starship, we had some great video of the differences between suborbital and orbital. With heavy boost, which is the first stage, it boosted up and then Starship separated and heavy boost came back down and there's no plasma associated with it. When you see the SpaceX Falcon 9, they go up and then they do a boost back burn. They deploy the flappy paddles, and they're slowed by air. If they were going at orbital speeds, the flappy paddles would burn up. Then when you saw Starship, because Starship completed an orbit and then did a re-entry towards the Indian Ocean. And they weren't planning on trying to land it. It was going to be crashed anyway. But with that, we got some of the best video ever of plasma effect. So people could finally see, yeah, this is why the space shuttle exploded all over Texas. Because if you don't have a really good heat shielding, you get a little bit of that in and it just blows it apart, which is something along the lines of what happened with Starship on this re-entry. So there's a specific technical definition of is it orbital or not? And that's the answer.
Absolutely. Well, with that technical definition, I guess we, if everyone else agrees, we can move on to the fun stuff. All right, Dave, I got the thumbs up.
We all okay?
Absolutely. So the one, if you want to see the difference, there is a famous parachute guy who dove from suborbital with the highest drop of the parachute for Red Bull back in the day, which the guy's got a brass set of balls. I would not have been the guy to do that first. Just putting that out there. But he jumped.
He exceeded the previous record, but he wasn't anything like the first person to do it. First person to do a drop from what was arguably space was in the 1950s.
Do you know who that was?
Can't remember the guy's name. But there was a movie with like Gary Cooper about it, which wasn't very accurate. But the guy's glove actually failed on the way down. So his hand was got kind of frostbitten on the way down. And landed in the Mojave Desert. And there's good video, good movie of, when they came up and this guy is out there in this kind of space suit and he's sitting on the ground and they come up and the first thing he does is they give him a cigarette and he lights it up, which is very 1950s. I can look it up, but
yeah, he was an Air Force test pilot.
The guy that did that with Red Bull was just going for a higher altitude record.
Okay, the guy from the Red Bull Stratus, it was at 24 miles up.
And one of the 1950s was U.S. Air Force.
Mach 1.25.
Yeah, the colonel was a test pilot. I can't remember his name. But you reminded me of it when you were describing it. And he was ejected, and there was a malfunction with the ejector, which was how he's damaged his glove. Because whatever he was test flighting was malfunctioning.
Okay, the original high-altitude jump was done by Colonel Joseph Kittner, 1960.
Yeah. There have been a number of people that have, done various high-altitude things along those lines. But those are all very, very much suborbital. Also, there's a difference between dropping from something which is essentially stationary in terms of the local air and dropping in something which is not. So even if you're talking about like a suborbital rocket, if you then try to punch out of that and do a free fall, good luck. It's not going to work very well. Humans are not very aerodynamic is why.
I will say in the Air Force's credit, and I'm not supposed to say nice things about the Air Force as an Army guy, but they document the history of space flight and early aviation very well. And they've got a lot of official Air Force website. Well, on the official Air Force website, they've got a lot of what's, I guess, public record now, the history stuff documented that they let the public see. So if you're curious, you can read up a lot of some of the official reports and whatnot from the stuff that's no longer classified, which is interesting if you love this kind of stuff to read the first people to do it. And sometimes they did it on purpose, and sometimes, like with that colonel, it was on accident because their plane failed.
Well, no, that was an intentional drop. It was the ejector was because they didn't think that he could physically just get away from the balloon well enough. They did the same thing with the Red Bull guy. I mean, it was a special seat. The Red Bull guy actually went into an out of control condition at one point, which was kind of interesting. But the one with Red Bull, they actually had video the whole way, most of the way down, which was also very interesting. I'm looking for my glasses, if you're wondering. I took my glasses off earlier because I was putting some eye drops in my eyes, and I don't know what I did with them, and there's not much around here for me to.
You're fine. So now that we got the scientific part out of the way, does everyone have a preference when you're reading about things like Halo's ODST, Helldivers, Starship Troopers, did the orbital pods that dropped with their mech suits or armor, which read to me a lot like a mech suit. Do you guys have a preference on how scientifically accurate they get? Or do you like the rule of cool?
Rule of cool, man. I like it when they're dropped from outer space and have to burn through an ozone.
I think that scientifically accurate and rule of cool are essentially identical. I don't think there's a separation there. If we're talking about an orbital drop, have you seen Helldivers?
I have.
Okay. The way that they actually slam into the ground, not very realistic unless they've got incredible inertial damping systems. I mean, really incredible inertial damping systems. But the way they're burning as they're coming down, very much what it would look like, which is cool. So I don't think that there is actually a choice between rule of cool. Now, when you get into scientifically accurate, you know, there's certain things in science fiction that you just accept, like anti-gravity and inertial damping systems and that sort of stuff. So, you know, what's the definition of scientifically accurate? It depends on the universe. In any reasonable universe, you'd be dealing with something that's a little bit closer to Starship Troopers, where you'd have a ribbon chute and then you'd have a main chute that would slow them down enough that they could then, using their mechs, jump out and land. Because you got to slow down somehow.
Well, so the ones that are using like retro rockets, you know, vector thrust, things like that, how plausible is that to you versus using chutes? Because I know you used to jump for the 82nd, right?
Yeah. Well, I can kind of see... I can kind of see the Helldiver ones. I haven't paid that much attention to the mechanics of the ODST, okay? But the Helldiver ones, they throw out panels at 4 points, and those panels are going to do aerial braking. But the problem is that they're coming in very, very fast, so that much aerial braking isn't going to work. So they're going to have some very, very powerful rockets to slow them down.
Okay.
And then if it wasn't for the way that they came in and they physically slam into the ground, if they came in more like the ODSTs where they have a rocket and they land, it would be more realistic. The Helldivers ones are cooler than ODSTs. ODST is probably a little closer to the accurate, except ODST doesn't have any way that it's actually slowing itself very effectively.
They have thrusters that engage at the end.
None of them are really super realistic, but they're all cool.
Hillbilly Dave, any opinions?
Honestly, I prefer accuracy over, you know, just the flash of cinematic. Cinematic is cool, but if it doesn't hold up to the science, I'd prefer it to hold up to science.
I'm going to be the only heretic in the group, man. If you can tell me a good story and fool me well enough, like if you can bullshit me well enough that I buy it, I'm down for rule of cool. Like if I later on find out that it's not accurate, I might be like, well, damn, they got me.
Well, but you know, I did a whole book in which the way that they do orbital insertion, I'm not even talking about suborbital, is they actually just strap armored vehicles to a unobtainium magic platform and kick them out of a ship. No. Even with all of the hand wavium that I did in it, no, it's nuts. It wouldn't actually work. But it's very, very cool. I mean, you've got essentially Leopard tanks and M1 Abrams, very, very upgraded with like plasma weapons that are strapped onto essentially the aluminum drop platforms, except of unobtainium.
Wait, what series is that?
Stabilize themselves to come down, and then there's this unobtainium thing that like just decelerates them as they get close to matter, which was built into the universe way, way back.
What series is that, John?
That's actually Eye of the Storm, which is in the Postlane universe, and ends on a cliffhanger. And I've never gone back to it.
That's just evil.
How they dare literally you, have sir.
Just done the drop and are just starting to get into combat, and the book ends, and I've never gone back to the universe. Yeah, it's just, it's like, what? And even I read it, and I go, what? Where's the rest of the book? And I'm like, I don't know.
Do you plan on going back to it?
Huh?
Do you plan on going back to it?
I'd love to. There's two more books, and I kind of have some bits for it, but I don't have enough for either one of the books. So that's always my problem. I hit a certain point, it's like I run out of steam.
So, okay.
Really, I don't have that book on the shelf. Thought I did.
Do better, Hillbilly. Do better.
I've got a lot of to be read. Shush.
I got it somewhere in this house.
Do you think the scenes where, I mean, obviously a lot of sci-fi is inspired by World War II massive combat. So like everyone just assumes spaceships are going to be like, you know, fighter jets in space. Do you think when you see that with orbital insertions that you want them to try to be realistic, or do you like the idea of them throwing up a wall of flak and somehow taking out these really essentially a bullet firing down at them?
You're
anybody
really,
besides me, because I've been doing a lot like of talk.
I think that you're kind of like, you have to kind of rule some things out, right? Because I mean, we have a modern system on aircraft carriers that'll rip things as small as a seagull out of the sky. So, you know, a couple of Sea Whiz on a freaking back of a tractor trailer, and you're ripping dropship troopers out of the sky before they get close enough to do you any harm. You know, so you have to find a way to either overcome that. You don't
drop right on an objective.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, orbital insertion means, objective. Yeah, you can hit the object, you know, you can insert, you know, pinpoint accuracy exactly where you want your forces to be. But the guys on the ground have nearly unlimited opportunity to destroy you on your way to the dirt, unless you're moving very fast.
And what you're going to drop in 1 to 2 miles out, bare minimum, before you even get to the target?
Well, I mean, I don't know, man. There was a choice I had where I was 10 miles out and we had to hump in. Still behind enemy lines, but 10 miles out and then we humped in.
Yeah, so. But that's okay. Let's just, we're talking about super unobtainium, right? And it depends on what universe of super unobtainium we're talking about. But let's take a look at Ukraine. American Air Force pilots, especially American Air Force generals and weenies, look at Ukrainian Air Force as being the nuttiest people in the fucking world, because these guys fly so low that their Mach plus fighter jets are scraping the tops of buses. And that's not an exaggeration. They literally have like knocked down street signs. They're flying so low. And these guys are going at 500, 600 miles an hour, two stories up. And it's like, that's insane. You just don't do that. That's nuts.
Yep. Speed is armor.
You in the SEAD, you know, in the anti-aircraft environment that they're in. Because if they go any higher, those Russian S-400s are going to knock them out of the sky.
Yeah.
So, yeah, one part of me says that any attempt at orbital insertion would automatically just be blown out of the sky. No. Well, and then people would say, well, they're coming in so fast and they can maneuver. Are we talking about people inside of pods? Do you have an inertial stabilization system? If you don't, they can't maneuver a whole hell of a lot, or they'll be smashed to bits. And then you go through a couple other things. But then you think about, how do you cover the entire world?
Right.
Right? Okay, so you don't know if they are capable of landing anywhere in the world and becoming a problem, then you don't know where they're going to be landing. And although you've got rockets that can cover a goodly distance, I saw an outlay one time of what Aegis could do, and it was like with PAC-6 and PAC-3, they can cover the entirety of the lower 48 with two ships in the Atlantic, two ships in the Pacific, and one in the Great Lakes. But those ships only carry so many missiles. If you're talking about divisions of troops being dropped in, plus like in Starship Troopers, where you've got a whole bunch of these pods that don't have guys in it, they might have bombs, but they maneuver in exactly the same way.
Yeah, decoys. They
have a bunch of freaking missiles. And each of those missiles is going to be very, very expensive.
Yeah. That is the problem when you look at it from a real-world logistics issue. That is one of the problems Israel has. Their Iron Dome is very good, but it's very expensive. So the cost to shoot down one of the missiles that Hamas is shooting, I mean, Hamas is throwing pennies, and Israel has to respond with $100 bills in equivalence of cost ratio. And so there's some benefits.
Sometimes you have to fly with a sledgehammer, man.
No, I'm not saying you don't. I'm just using it as an example of sometimes you've got – high tech will only get you so far is what I'm saying, because you can only have so many of those.
Why would they care? We're the ones funding it anyway. I mean
– Well, that's a separate discussion. I was using it as an example of the limitations of a system like that designed to take stuff out.
Right. But if that's all you have, and unfortunately it's an expensive system, like really in science fiction, you don't need to be sending ground troops. You can pepper the planet from orbit. You know, if you have that type of technology, you can just wipe it out. And then, you know, like the movie Starship Troopers, you know, fleet takes care of it from space. Mobile infantry mops up. That's it. You know?
Right.
So like, I do like the stories that are written about putting the human element and actually putting boots on ground, because that was my job in the Army, you know, to be boots on ground, to occupy space. And so I do like reading those stories about it, past, present, future, and what else, you know, because they're interesting stories, because no one's going to want to read 350 pages of, oh yeah, we showed up to the planet and then we just start dropping bombs on these assholes, you know? And then when everyone was dead, then we just kind of landed. And then we planted our little flag, and then we said hurrah, and then we had a banquet as the Air Force, you know, and there was like lobster.
Sorry, I was just thinking of Halo books from the point of view of the Covenant. That's a Halo book like, from what? The point of view of the Covenant. We just came in and we completely sterilized the planet, and then we landed, and there were some big guys, and we killed most of them, and some of them got away.
We did it again. We moved to the next planet. And then we created a giant freaking ring.
But I think the reason that these stories are so popular is the same reason people like the Call of Duty games, where you go back to World War II and you get to land on Omaha. That's why Saving Private Ryan's opening scene was so popular. It's because people want to envision themselves in the stories and be the hero. Right? With plot armor, of course, because in real life, crap happens, and sometimes stray bullet, and you know,
you're generally not the hero. You're generally the body on the beach.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just right place, wrong time, and that was that.
Yeah, well, you know, you were 75th.
Second Ranger John.
So back in the day. Cold War, 82nd Airborne Division's job in the event of the balloon going up was either to do reforger, which was to jump into Germany and proceed to, we don't know, basically get overrun by the Soviet Army, because we had like dragons to fight T-72s, and that was going to work out really freaking well.
And you don't snap the wire.
But our, like, the ultimate, this is just totally crazy one that they had for us, was we were supposed to drop into, there were three passes in the mountains in Iran. that if the Soviets were sending down forces from Ukraine, they would have been Ukrainian forces to take the Persian Gulf oil field. We were supposed to drop a brigade, one battalion into each of these passes. And the first battalion was anticipated to last 6 hours. It was like, you need to hold them for a total of 48 hours. And, you know, and then we'll be able to get reinforcements into the Persian Gulf area. And we're like, dude, it's going to take you 6 months to get the Persian Gulf area in a nuclear war. It isn't going to happen. We're just going to die in Iran. That was
in
it.
A field of glass.
In a field of glass.
So, yeah, that's what they told us. A buddy of mine went to Korea. It was on the parallel. And they were told they were expected to hold the line for 15 minutes to give the time for the people in the rear to mobilize. Now, I don't know if that's still true or not, but in the early aughts, that's what he was told. So, well, yeah, it's, first in is sometimes dangerous.
One of the things to think about is, okay, so why would you do an orbital drop at all? Are you trying to take a planet? Like, are you trying to conquer a planet?
Well, whether you're trying to conquer a planet or a region or a country, yeah, so an orbital drop is an instant. You know, you're there.
Right. But let's think about the concept of, okay, think about Iraq, right? So we sent an army into Iraq. How well did that work out? It kind of did in the end. They're sort of democratic, mostly. Mm. How long did it take? How many troops did we have to send? Okay. So you're doing an orbital drop. You're trying to take
fucking
over
all of them.
Huh?
Say again? We sent fucking all of them. Everybody went. All the Allied forces, the Australians, British, us.
The Belgians.
El Salvadorians. The Belgians.
Canada.
No, Canada doesn't have an army. They just have lumberjacks with maple leaves.
That's an army. That's the best story. I love going to their camps.
Which is like going off topic, but my favorite story on that, in terms of the coalition, was Mongolia sent a battalion.
Wait,
really?
Yeah. We used to be, I don't know what our current status is, but we used to be pretty good allies with Mongolia. But Mongolia sent a battalion. And the commander of it was like, he graduated from Harvard, War College, the whole thing. And So he's getting up, he's up there, he's giving the speech, you know, very happy to help the coalition and establish democracy in Iraq, blah, 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 blah. And he finishes it with, and we really hope that this visit by Mongolian forces to Iraq will be better than the last one. And let me show you.
Thousands of years prior to the engagement in Iraq,
that sector had like zero incidents. It had been a soft sector before they came in, and then the year that they were there, zero incidents. Like the crime rate dropped.
They were eating the beef.
Like, oh shit, the Mongolians are here. the barbecue is gone.
Please don't kill all of us again.
All right. Well, since we've got a good lull in the conversation, we're going to pause for a moment and shamelessly shill for the man. Boom.
Southside thief Kai Fletcher thought he could go straight until he couldn't. And when his last job goes wrong, he finds himself stowed away in a starship belonging to an alien crime syndicate. Forced into servitude to pay for his passage off world, Kai makes a deal. He helps them rob the most powerful alien empire in known space, and he gets to go home. Easy peasy. Until it isn't. Planning the heist, Kai discovers the Empire has stolen ancient alien technology that threatens all other sentient species. He's never been a good guy, but even he has limits. Hunted by both the Empire and the Syndicate, he manages to get on the wrong side of everyone in the galaxy who wants the discovery for themselves. Kai just wanted to get back to Chicago, but instead, he's become the galaxy's most wanted sci-fi thrill ride from Michael Lavoisse and Athon Books. Available at Amazon.com and Audible.
So there's one problem with that story, with the suspension of disbelief. Who the heck is fighting to get back to Chicago?
That's what I was about to say, JR. I was like, how messed up is your universe where Chicago is the place you
right? I'm going to have to get on Michael about that. Because
it could be worse. It could be Detroit.
Chicago.
Actually, I'm going to message him right now. I'm like, dude.
Chicago? Just really wanted a good pizza.
And what I heard, too, deep dish is for the tourists. They have a different style of actual Chicago pizza. That's not a deep dish. Deep dish is apparently for the tourists.
Good to know.
At least that's what I heard.
You get a Lubinati's deep dish with the chunk of sausage and the chunk of cheese. Oh, my dear God, that is one hell of a pizza.
I'm going to do an AFK for just a second. I'll be out.
That is a fine pie.
Is it just the Chicago pizza? You know, how did we get talking about food? It's Hillbilly's fault.
You brought it up.
We all love chow, man. All of us were in.
Yeah.
Every single one of us. What did we talk about?
Wings chow. Expect anything else.
We used to have
like I was staring at a dead guy's skull. He tried to V-bet us. Turned out it wasn't a V-bet. He was just a guy that didn't want to wait in traffic. And one of the gunners in the cordon hit him with a 50 cal. Well, didn't hit him. It went by him. And those things will, like, take your scalp off. And it's the grossest thing I've ever seen. It's me and this guy named Gilhouse. I'm eating an apple. And it was getting pretty close to 1700 when they started serving dinner chow. And he looks at me and he's like, think chow's going to be open when we get there? Because it was like Taco Tuesday. You know, we're watching Fly's Cranium. It was like real gross. You know, his brains are in the backseat. It was a very horrid, traumatizing moment. I'm eating an apple with a dip in. I give him a dip. He puts one in and he's worrying about, is chow going to be open? You know, are we going to be able to make it to chow?
We were in Missoula when they were bombing the DFAC. They hit the main DFAC. There was a secondary DFAC on the Missoula base, and they were evacuating that one too because they thought it was going to get hit. And some rounds did land close to it. And we just were like, dude, it's veal. We're not leaving. And we just sat there and ate. One of your ranger buddies was there, and he called BS.
I need to eat. To hell with your income.
Right?
Mine was out on a run at Bagram when they started to get some rockets coming in. And he was a major. And Army and there's a bunch of Air Force guys running along and they're like, what do we do? What do we do? He says, okay, I'm gonna lie down on the ground. You guys lie on top of me. So he laid down on the ground, they all lay on top of him. And they're like, what does this do? He goes, well, if one of them hits close by, it'll get you and not me. Right? So they don't see all clear. They start getting up and they're like, man, that was bullshit. Gonna kick your fucking ass. He goes, okay, if you really want to pick a fight with a major, you can, because they're all in PT gear, right? It's like, fuck. So we just keep running.
You may beat my ass, but all of you getting UCMJ.
So the worst part was
you might be able to beat my. He said, "You might be able to beat the ass of an army major." That's actually how he phrased it. You might be able to beat. You know, there's six of you, one of me. You might be able to beat the ass of an army major. And they were like,
"Yeah, the Tuesday was on that one."
When we were at the DFAC, I ran into one of Nick's former Ranger guys. And he was like telling us, he's calling BS because he didn't think I was there because he was. So I pulled out the picture of me sitting in that DFAC. He goes, no shit, that was you. And he's like zooming in on the back. He's like, that's my leg right there. And I'm like, yeah, it was veal. He goes, oh, you got veal? We had lobster. And I'm like, why didn't we get lobster? Well, they didn't like us as much, I guess.
SOCOM. Yeah, SOCOM budget.
And apparently they didn't go to Bombs and Bullets. They went to Lobsters. I'm kind of jealous. But as they say, that recruiting
office. Yeah, but they didn't cook them right. And the tail was kind of rubbery. Yeah.
So maybe that's a reason why our landing with an orbital assault, getting us back on topic, is they have really good chow down on planet side. Like, I don't really want to invade, but they get good food.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that would actually
like, be we're going to have like Talaxian lobsters, you know.
Well, you know, Elon Musk, he wants to build a Mars colony. And there's a lot of stuff, in, again, in Expanse, which is about how crap the food is. And it's because you don't have any place to grow anything. So the reason to take a planet like Earth is because you can just grow shit on it. And that's totally the reason to get it. And it's probably the only argument for an alien invasion is what's called a protein raid. Because planets with life can produce food. And all of the things like hydroponics and everything else that they talk about, oh, we can produce stuff in space. You're not going to be able to do it as effectively as on the surface of the planet because you just don't have miles and miles and miles of soil.
Yeah.
Water, sunlight, all the air, all the things that plants need are right on the surface of the planet.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes. It's got electrolytes and shit.
I caught that reference. So I'm going to call that a win.
That's, it's a great reference. It was supposed to be a satire, not the blueprint for how our society is at 2024.
Oh, dear God. Yeah, really. It is. Yeah.
It's here because I went to Carl's Jr.
So fast. It's just, it's incredible. Oh, hard.
I went to Carl's Jr. and it was the automated response, like an Idiocracy. Welcome to Carl's Jr. Can I take your order, please? It wasn't a human being. It was an automated response. I'm like, yeah, I want my jalapenos, please.
Okay, so obviously, you know, capturing the land, if you want to capture it without glassing it, that's a good reason. Because if you destroy too much, you know, maybe you want the infrastructure in place so you don't want to rods from God, the solution. Do you guys prefer individual drop ships or the drop pod approach where it's kind of the equivalent of the Mike boats from World War II?
Well, for me, I look at it from a paratrooper's perspective because that's really when we're talking about like ODSTs and hell divers and shit, they're paratroopers dialed to 11. You know, so you got to think about like what is the airborne's purpose in today's conventional warfare or unconventional warfare, you know. This is our mission. Our mission is to occupy a specific target, usually an airfield, a bridge, some sort of infrastructure that is going to be a benefit to us if we own it. So for ODSTs, Helldivers, it's a conjunction of sending those guys in, and then you have landing craft. Now, one of my things when I was a baby ranger in 275 in the mid-90s, like you had the jump clearing team. Your job was to take over the airfield and remove any obstructions so the C-130s or the 141s can land and then come out and start doing their shit. You know, I think it applies too into science fiction. That is your objective, where you get on the ground over key infrastructure. Because that's what airborne does. And that's all we're talking about is a airborne unit dialed to dialed to 15, like the hell divers, you know? So that's my stance on it. You got to look at what the mission objective is. It's really one of those things that it doesn't need to be the rule of cool, even though it is kind of cool jumping out of a perfectly good aircraft, whether it's an orbit or suborbit or orbital. It allows you to talk shit to the Pokes, you know?
It depends on the tech. It really does. You know, what universe you're talking about, what sort of technology you have. Yes. Airborne is supposed to take... Airborne takes key terrain, which airports are... Airports, ports, that sort of thing are in the
and they're usually the associated key with key infrastructure, like ports, airports, electrical...
Ranger was like, Honda. you take key targets because you guys are too light to take key terrain. But what you have to think about is the technology. So, for example, you're probably not all familiar with my Troy universe. One of the things about the ships in the Troy universe is that they can generate up to 1,000 gravities. Okay, so something can generate 1,000 gravities. You've got the equivalent of battleships that can land. Okay, so if you've got the equivalent of battleships that can land, it makes more sense to put down a ship that has a whole bunch of troops on it and to, you know, to have landing craft. Whereas if you have something that doesn't get in and out of orbit particularly well, then it makes more sense to drop individual groups onto, or for example, you take one of David Weber's universes, not Weber, Drake's universe, right, where the ships have to have a cradle that they land on, right? So that's the equivalent that you're talking about of taking an airport. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the special operations drop troopers, their job would be to make sure that the handling system is operable. So they'd have to have like handling system assets with them to figure out, you know, to make sure that the handling system is operable. And then the ship comes in and the regular military regiment comes out. Well, right.
Then you're talking about combat controllers, like, you know, the Air Force dudes getting out there, securing the airfields, making sure everything's good to go for our guys to come in.
Well, I think it might be like a both and, right? Like your drop troopers are like the airborne, like the Rangers. They're there for specific objectives, key pieces of infrastructure and terrain. And then when you really show up to take and hold ground or to, you know, to pacify / occupy, then that's, you know, large craft, you know, with company sized outfits in them that, you know, they hit the ground and deploy, and you're dropping 5-6 companies on a spot.
You got to have some way to get the bolos down, right?
You got to land the armor and shit.
Once the bolos are on the ground, the crunchies don't matter anymore.
Okay. So do you, this is just mostly a preference. When you read about these kinds of assaults, do you prefer to read it from the point of view of the guy making the drop or the guy repelling the drop?
Oh, the making the drop. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. The guy making the drop. Like I just jumped into Rick Partlow's Drop Trooper series, and it's, you know, at least so far, book one is entirely from the point of view of a guy that's, you know, joining the Marines to become a drop, you know, he ends up becoming a dropship trooper. And like, that's definitely where it's at, man, for me to read it.
Oh yeah. I mean, the whole concept, if I was a billionaire, right, as old as I am, as out of shape as I am, as much as I fucking hated jumping, and I did, I fucking hated jumping. I hated every single jump. And lo and behold, decades later, now that I'm writing science fiction and I'm meeting guys that are like I met a general who was, you know, the assistant division commander for the 82nd Airborne Division. He's got the master blasters and all that. Like, man, I hated jumping. And he goes, everybody hates jumping, right? There were like 10% of guys in the airborne that loved it. But if I was a billionaire, I would go to Elon Musk. I would say just once, I'll be dropped actually freaking orbital, burn in reentry in a capsule. I got pumped out of it and it fucking parachuted in just once in my life. You Starship Troopers, just once in my life. But I'm not a billionaire.
Yeah, and you would be cool to be on the bounce. I'm just saying. Those suits. I mean, other than, like, I've read it with modern eyes, other than that everything was nuclear based, like, I think he had a good handle on the science that it's lasted so long as far as it goes. Heinlein, I mean. But it makes sense. He designed spacesuits for NASA.
He was taking a combination of Marines in World War II, Airborne in World War II, and the suits, he said, it was about, okay, so you have a really nuclear battlefield where you're just throwing nukes around like popcorn. How do soldiers survive in that? And they had to have fully contained suits that were
everybody's packing tack nukes.
Huh? Yeah, I mean they had they had the equivalent of a light anti-tank weapon. They used a Davy Crockett round.
Yeah.
You know, these guys did not mess around. Oh, tanks? We've got an answer for that. Nuclear weapons.
Well, and they did that well in the movies. They showed that multiple times over.
Yeah, that these guys did not, you know, with cap troopers, there is no such thing as overkill.
I mean, that's true in modern warfare. If it's a fair fight, then you didn't do it right. I don't imagine that ever changing. So, do you think that...
I'm pretty sure that's been true of warfare, you know, from the time that, you know, Thag picked up a club.
Look, I'm just saying Thog had it coming, all right? He looked at the man's food a little bit wrong. He had to die.
You looking at me? You looking at me?
So, do you guys have a preference when it comes to that of the stories that have the assault, orbital assault type scenarios? Do you want them to get really granular into the, you know, the ballistics and the orbital mechanics, or do you like them just to sort of hint that it's happening and then show more from the internal monologue point of view? Do you guys have a preference in how that's done in fiction?
In science fiction, there should always be a certain amount of data dump, but it can be too much. And all stories should revolve around characters. So one of the ways that I do it, just from a writing perspective, you know, a way to write, is that I'll write something that's kind of a minor cliffhanger, and then I'll do a data dump, and I'll try to keep the data dump to under 1,000 words, preferably about 500. And that kind of gives the time for what's actually going on. You're describing what's going on when you're not too sure if the character is going to make it or not. A character is not going to make it or not. Classic example of that is in one of my books, a sniper takes a really long shot. And it goes into the details of the ballistics and how the round travels and everything else. And the question is he going to take out, the enemy commander that he can see, the enemy commander, and is he going to be able to do it, or is he going to miss? So it gives time for the tension to build a little bit, and then you finalize it with it's either successful or it's unsuccessful. Does that answer the question?
It does. What about you, Hillbilly? Do you have a preference?
Repeat the question.
So the question was, when it comes to telling those kinds of stories, do you want them to focus more on just the character and sort of hint that that they're doing the orbital drop? Everyone's seen the Halo. Everyone's seen Helldivers. Kind of have an idea at this point what it is. You don't have to get as granular, if you don't want to, about the physics of it. Do you have a preference in how that's told? Do you want to still keep some of that science, or do you want them just to get to the cool parts?
I personally skip, you know, okay, David Weber, love his writing. I skip the physics lessons because I want to get into the story. I want to see more about the characters and what's going on. If it's absolutely relevant, I'll keep reading it. But, you know, the minutia, I tend to skip it.
Okay. What about you, Dave?
Man, I'm a fan of the Tom Clancy style, you know, info dump when I'm reading, right? Especially if they can find a way to take all that granularity and make it critical to the story down the road. I'm a big fan of that. And I'm plagued with having to know why something is or how something works. So if you can feed me a bunch of stuff at that, you know, high level of detail and not bore me with it, like, man, I'm down for as much of it as you want to shovel to me.
Okay. Nick, you have a preference when you're reading?
As far as? I have a lot of preferences when I'm reading. Sometimes I'm naked in a beanbag chair eating Cheetos.
How much data dump do you want, Nick?
How much data dump do you want? How much science do you want them to tell you, and how much do you just want to get to the fighting?
I don't. It's weird. Like, I'm a big Tom Clancy fan, so I'm with Dave on this one. I do like the info dump and how it plays out later on in the story. I don't know. It's like, I think it has to be like a mixed bag. It has to be an even balance of info dump and everything else. I don't know. There's some writers that can give you an info dump that is in such a good way that you're actually kind of enticed by it and it brings you further into the story. And
right,
some authors that they give you that info dump and you're like, why the fuck are you telling me this shit, man? I don't effing care. Blow something up.
Have you ever read James Michener's Hawaii?
No.
I have not. But write it down. I'll put it on the list. Like Captain America. Here.
It's not a recommendation. It's not a bad book. Okay. But the first five chapters of it are a history of Hawaii going back to how it formed from volcanoes.
Okay. See, you know, that's information I would like to know.
And it's well written. But that's one of the things with Michener books is that he goes back like to how they formed geologically, what the early botany of the was, how it was colonized and everything else. So I was doing some research on a book I'll never write, and I found this island in the French Carolinas in the Pacific. And I can't remember the exact name, but it was like Ta Manu Pawawa Isle Island. Right.
God bless you.
And it was longer than that, right? There was an Otto and, you know, blah blah. Yeah. So where did that come from? Well, when the first people colonized this little island, which there's a central island in it, and the island that's talking about is one of the large uninhabited rock islands that's out there. It's a basalt island. When the first people inhabited it, they just said, well, that's a particular type of rock island. And that was like Manu. And then when the next people like conquered it, they went, well, they call it Manu. So that's Manu and their word for island. And what it is it's nine words long. And every single one of them is a different name for it. It just means fucking island, 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 island. But that's the fun stuff when you hit a rabbit hole. And I actually, the book that I've got coming out this month, Beyond the Ranges, I actually built that into it. So sometimes when you go down those rabbit holes, you run across stuff that you can just throw into a book.
Well, I think it all just comes down to like how it fits into the story and how it develops the world.
Yeah.
So that type of research, I mean, you could plug that into a million different stories that would all be interesting. So I think you should write that book. I know you said it's a book I'm never going to write, but shit, man, give it a crack. Is that, it sounds interesting. You have you created the lore and then you can move forward with that.
What book did you say? Were you talking to me about
the island? The
Volcano Island, you said, is a book you might not ever write.
No, I wrote it into a book. It's the book that's coming out.
Oh,
the character who
it's the book you weren't going to write. Did I miss something?
No, I've got Beyond the Ranges is coming out in May.
Okay, is that the Gamelet one you were talking about earlier?
No, that's not the Gamelet one. It's a colonization story. It's a humanity just all of a sudden gets picked up, gets kidnapped, and gets spread out among multiple different terraformed worlds because the Earth was destroyed. And so they start off with kind of high-level tech and a terraformed world. And my publisher, Tony Weisskopf, did not particularly like it because she said it's just a story about a guy going fishing. And yeah, fishing that's is it. Important. Huh?
Fishing is important.
Yeah, well,
it is. So is hunting.
So is the old man in the sea.
Yeah, well, Tony wouldn't like the old man in the sea. Tony likes space stuff. Tony likes science stuff. And there's space and there's science in here, but she's not an outdoors person. And this is very much a story about a guy who he's been rejuvenated. He was 60. He's 20 again. Everybody who was above the age of 20 is pushed down to 20. And he's got a whole world to explore. That's the worst part about the fishing is every time he throws a line in, something hits it. He's like, the fishing on this planet is just too easy. And that, to a great extent, is what it's about, along with a certain amount of stuff having to do with the tech and that sort of thing. But like when he first goes down to the planet, all of the animals, and this is something that would be true if you were to terraform a world and there were no humans involved in terraforming it, all of the animals are bigger. And it's because humans always go after trophy animals, so they become smaller. So the bison are like almost the size of elephants, and the elephants are gigantic, and the bears are huge, and the crocodiles are huge. And
you'd be drunk enough, I'll fight every one of those.
He figured out a way to get down there, but the problem is that the biggest thing he's got is a 30-06.
Oh.
And
you need some damage with that, though. Like,
his whole thing is, he's like, I need a bigger gun. And every person that he talks to, because this is the conservative planet, and like every American that he's talking to, they're all 2A. And they're all like, you went down there with a 30-06? You need a bigger gun.
You need like a 300 Win Mag. What are you doing?
Oh, yeah. There's all sorts of discussions of large caliber bullets and, you know.
A lapua would be nice.
Huh? Well, he was actually in the gun industry. So at a certain point, somebody says, you know, something about a 458 Win Mag. And he's like, ah, the 458 Win Mag, right? And he starts going into like the John Wick connoisseur thing, right?
Yeah.
About, you know, with
robust, but strong.
As the 470 Nitro Express, but a lighter, more gentle recoil, right?
Oh, just give me a 50 cal API.
I mean, and he's like,
because I'm not want to cook it as I kill
around this planet. I'm not carrying a Barrett with me around this planet. Forget it.
Of course not. They're fucking heavy. I had to carry one up at a grain silo once in Iraq. I hated every rung of that ladder. And then I hated my spotter.
God, yes.
And I hated myself for taking the damn mission. And then I hated the gun.
So this isn't particularly...
Stripping it down, like...
So this
no, it is, kind of. Because you have to jump with that shit.
Again.
Man, everyone's lagging tonight, and we apologize, dear listener, for putting up with it. Sometimes the internet gods love us, and sometimes, well, not so much. We need to burn some incense to the internet Fios god or something. I don't know. But so, just as a reference, because this is one thing I see sci-fi, mil sci-fi fans get really heated about. So, do you have a preference, plasma or ballistics or electromagnetic rounds for your future combat infantry guys? I think all work. I don't get that picky, but some people will argue to the heat death of the universe why one is better than the other.
Standard ballistics or electromagnetic. I mean, plasma is just too hard to deal with.
Okay. Dave?
I've done all of them, but I would
I'm
say
a fan
that
of all of the
for,
above.
For most stuff, kinetic.
Okay. Nick always likes things that go boom. So do you have a preference?
I like kinetic bullets, man. I like gunpowder. Not that I have anything against electromagnetic rounds or plasma, but that shit requires energy. And batteries, as we all know, especially when you need it the most, will go dead on you. You know, the battery will die out on your CCO. The battery will die on your GPS. The battery will die on your electromagnetic weapon, your real gun, or your plasma weapon, too. So I guess it's all dependent on how those systems work that don't require a whole lot of energy. And it's something that, like, is easy to find. But, like, with a ballistic weapon, bullets, gunpowder, that shit... It rarely fails you. You know, you pull the trigger, the hammer hits the initiator, and like the rest is good to go. You know, but plasma, it's like, oh, I don't have enough energy and I don't have enough charge. It's like running around with a taser all the time, which I have a taser at work. You know, and batteries just die. They just lose juice, you know.
All right. So last question, because I'm running out of ideas because we kind of hit all of them early on, getting all scientific and crap. So do you think the terrain and or the temperature, so like whether it's landing in a rainforest versus a desert versus the mountains, do you think any of that, if we're at the point where we're doing orbital drops, makes much of a difference? My gut says probably not. If you can do an orbital drop, you can compensate for wherever you're landing. But anyone else have strong opinions one way or another?
I think it changes how you fight.
Yeah.
What type of terrain you're in changes how you fight. Example of that, in World War II, one of the reasons that Truman became vice president was because he ran an armed forces committee on waste and mismanagement in the army. And he made a big thing about the fact that he had been a captain of artillery, and the U.S. government had overproduced the 105 millimeter round in comparison to the 155 millimeter round. As proven by what happened in North Africa. So then when they went into Northern Europe, they ran out of 105. And the reason they did was because in North Africa, they were fighting at longer ranges. Everything was open. And they were shooting at each other at longer ranges. And so you could also see stuff further away, so you could bring in 105 on it. When they got into Europe, where they're at closer quarters, they couldn't afford to bring in 105 because it was just too close. And they used a lot more, or pardon me, they couldn't use 155. They used 155 in Africa. When they got into Europe, they were using a lot more 105. So the biome, which is what you were really talking about, changes the way that you fight. And I don't know that it would necessarily hugely change the way that you would do an orbital drop into it, but what you would bring with you would be different.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. All right. Well, we had our hour. Unless anyone has anything they want to add to the conversation, we can bring it home and talk about what we're all writing and wrap this puppy up. I know John said he hadn't slept in a couple of days because, you know, he's been in the dungeon writing.
My South American prison cell.
Look,
at least they give you internet.
Oh yeah, I got top quality. I'm not lagging because I've got APB-Fi, which I figure Hillbilly's got that too.
And now we got Chickamauga, but it's tied right into EPB.
Yeah, so I've got EPB fiber, which is like you can't get below 1 gig.
Yeah.
Nice. That's
the lowest they have now is 1 gig. And it goes up to 10, and they're getting ready to go to 20.
So I actually have a hamster running on a wheel powering the two seashells that connected with string, and that's what Dave has too. And it's not working great, but, you know, what are you going to do? It's what we have locally.
Yes, it is.
I have Starlink.
Yeah. So, John, what are you writing now? Or is it you writing a sequel to the one you just finished?
I am working on the sequel to Beyond the Ranges, which is colonization story. I briefly touched on that. At the same time, I am also working on the sequel to Through the Storm with Lydia Shearer. And I'm continuing the series, which is the Substack, which making it you can't describe it as a single genre. It's a cyberpunk YA spy versus spy super universe. And I've finally gotten into the big catastrophe where John Rigo wipes out the human race again. And so that's the Substack. And those
with
are
the zombies enough. You killed everybody with the zombies.
Yeah, I know. I mean, how many times is it going to kill off the human race? it's like I don't like people or something. Those are the three main things that I'm working on. Also, just had another Black Tide anthology come out last month, I think. Black Tide, that was United We Stand. So after a very, very long hiatus, I have a whole bunch of stuff coming out like within the last 3 months. and I'm working on sequels to it.
Nice. Classic overachiever. Man. Well, hopefully they were.
I actually wrote 8 books in the last year.
Nice. Damn. Hopefully they let you out of your jail cell for food and exercise in the yard. And we'll work on that for next time. All right, Dave, what are you working on right now?
I'm wrapping up in final edits on book one of a 3-book series collaboration with you, with JR. That's Ghost Ship Derelict. That is far future space marines. These guys are ostensibly showing up to perform a search and rescue operation on a derelict ship. Turns out that they've bitten off a little bit more than they can chew.
Wait. Who told you it was only a trilogy?
Oh, well, you know, I'm willing to write 30 of the damn things that they sell.
All right. And weren't you working on the Car Wars stuff, too? I thought you had a
novel. Yeah, we just had the Car Wars anthology drop, which I have a detective noir story in there about an insurance investigator who's sort of the Car Wars version of Johnny Dollar, if anybody remembers that old radio show.
And it was damn good, too.
You guys are showing your age. All right, what about you, Hillbilly? What are you working on?
I'm working on the first modern Joint Task Force 13 novel, Blacktooth Wren. My goal is to have it out by LibertyCon.
Nice. That is ours with the edits as well. So we'll have to have you back for a panel on JTF 13 where we just kind of dig into it because it's interesting concept. Something Nick and Stabby would both dig as well. So, Nick, it's modern military fighting, like paranormal stuff on Earth. Not a fantasy general. Like, yeah.
Okay. Still falls into military fantasy, but.
Yeah. But, I mean, tanks versus dragons. Like, how cool is that?
Yeah, exactly.
Super cool.
So, all right, Nick, what are you drawing at the moment?
I got inspired by our conversation, so let me just share it with you because that's what I do.
Okay, you're starting with
I was drawing an orbital dude. Yeah,
nice. When that comic goes live, we'll talk about it. Not that you don't have like hundreds of comics you're trying to get back out. And as Dave said, working on that series with him in edits, and then doing the trilogy with James. I'm on the second book. And I realized that as I was writing today, well, yesterday, I guess, how much I relied on James to be the knowledge of all things fantastical and historical when it comes to the Egyptians. So I'm like, crap, I can't just call him anymore. So I've had to actually dive into research and reading up about like cultural stuff and dragging out my gods and demigods manual because it has the Egyptian pantheon in it. So if someone already did the work, like, why work extra? So I'm working on those two at the same time. And, man, there's danger in research because I like it so much that I could get sucked in and you won't see me for a decade. And, you know, I just, like, covered in ink in a library. Yeah. So, all right, with that out of the way, we're going to go round robin. Staying with you, Hillbilly, how can they find you on the Wild Wild interwebs?
Look for me at williamjosephroberts.com or 3ravenspublishing.com. I am pretty much on every social media page that you can look up.
All right. That makes it easy. You're a digital strumpet, and we'll take it.
Whore. Are you kidding me?
I was trying to be family friendly, but I guess, you know.
Whore. I love it.
What about you, Dave? Where can they find you on the Wild Wild interwebs?
Andy Locke.
You can find me at davidwhensley.com. You can find me at David Hensley Writes on Facebook. Am I lagging again?
No, you're good. Keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can find me at davidwhensley.com and David Hensley. And find me at David Hensley Writes on Facebook and D Hensley Writes on Instagram.
And we will link to all of that in the show notes. What about you, John? How can they find you on the Wild Wild Interwebs?
I actually have a website back up for the first time in a decade or more. It's ringotavern.com. Ringo's Tavern.com. It's an S.
Facebook. I have a fan page. I also have my personal page where I do a lot of stuff and I occasionally tweet. And I have a Substack, which is John Regal Off. And I think those are all of them.
All right. And this is the part where I remind you to please be kind and speak your mind on the reviewing platforms. Your reviews help the right readers find the right book. So do your part, people. And it definitely helps the algorithms when it comes to what the selling platforms recommend to new readers. So you are helping get the more of the books you like by recommending them to friends and family. So you know, you help each other out, right? With that being said, you can find us on our Linktree, linktr.ee, Linktree/Blasters and Blades Podcast. Again, Linktree/Blasters and Blades Podcast, where we link to all the things, the BitChutes, the Rumbles, the YouTubes, our TikTok. We have our email, blastersandbladespodcast@gmail.com. Again, blastersandbladespodcast@gmail.com. We have our Facebook group and Facebook page. And more importantly, we have Madam Stabby Stab over there on the Instagram, Twitters, and emails. We have our website, anchor.fm/blasters-and-blades. Again, anchor.fm/blasters-and-blades, where for as little as 99 cents a month, you can help keep the lights on. Every penny helps. Or you can support the show more directly at buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Handley. Again, buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Handley. Be sure to put in the comment section that it is for the podcast. And I promise I will keep my co-hosts duly caffeinated. They will drink some of that coffee brand coffee. Use our discount code podcastgrunts for 10% off. Or, you know, we can go old school and we could drink some of that Irish whiskey. Hillbilly was showing up on the screen a few minutes ago. That Patty's, we've got a, got to try some of that on payday. I'm going out to buy some on the first. So either way, thank you for spending some of your precious time with us. For my crazy co-host, I am J.R. Handley, and this was the Blasters and Blades Podcast. We'll be back next week at the same time where we'll indulge our love of nerd culture, cheesy jokes, and all things that go boom. Thank you, each and every one of you, for coming on the show tonight. This was a lot of fun. Hopefully next time the internet will be more cooperative. Dave, don't forget to sacrifice a goat or something next time. I think that will help. No, with that, we are out.
Small child, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, whatever.